Random House Audio presents Another Great Day at Sea, Life Aboard the USS George H.W. Bush by Jeff Dyer. Read for you by Jonathan Cowley. Chapter 1. We were going to be flying to the carrier from the US Navy base in Bahrain on a Grumman C-2A Greyhound, an ungainly propeller plane, more war or workhorse than Greyhound. There was nothing sleek or speedy about it. The sky was doing what it always did at this time, waiting for the sun to show up. The sun is the only thing that happens to the sky in this part of the world. That and the stars, which were nowhere to be seen. The temperature was pleasant. A few hours from now it would be infernal. 16 passengers, all Navy except for me and the snapper, gathered round the back of the Greyhound, also known as a COD, carrier onboard delivery, listening to the safety briefing. Our luggage had been weighed and taken away for loading. Despite my protests, I had to hand over my computer bag as well, something I'd never let happen before. It had to be stowed because when we landed on the carrier, when the plane touched down and hooked the arresting wire, we would go from 140 miles per hour to 0 miles per hour in a couple of seconds. The trap, the first of many words that I heard for the first time, or rather the first of many times that I heard a familiar word used in a completely new way. I knew what the trap referred and pertained to, the hook, the arresting wire, but was unsure how to use it. Did we make the trap? Hit the trap? Come in for the trap? The trap. It existed in isolation from other words, abruptly and permanently arrested from the normal momentum of syntax. Then there was the word cranial. In this context, not an adjective, as in massage, but a noun referring to the head, ear, and eye protectors that were handed out for the flight. Unnoticed, I notice now, the sky had brightened from grey to blue. We put on our float coats, carried our cranials, and filed onto the plane. There were two seats on either side of the aisle, all facing backwards, and two windows on either side of the fuselage, each the size of a dinner plate. It was not the sort of environment in which one could complain about the lack of legroom, though that was one of the striking features of this aircraft. Others were fumes and noise. The ramp we'd walked up winched itself closed and sealed us in. Further safety checks were made. This involved shining a torch as though to see if there were holes in the fuselage. There must have been more to it than that, but holes in a fuselage are good things to check for, obviously. The woman who made these checks was the military equivalent of a flight attendant. She was wearing a sand-coloured flight suit, looked as tough as a woman in an Annie Prue story. There was nothing of the trolley dolly, nothing chicken or beef, or doors to manual about her. But when she sat down in front of me, prior to takeoff, I saw that her hair had been plaited and pinned into a tight bun on the back of her head. The Navy allowed women to keep their hair long. I wasn't surprised exactly, just pleased that's how things were. We were not taxiing, but a noisy increase in power had taken place and the noise was deafening. I'd thought the noise was deafening when we'd first boarded, but back then I didn't know anything about noise or deafeningness. It sounded like the flight of the Phoenix. Felt like it too, even though we were not actually moving, let alone flying. This was the moment, evidently, to put on my ear-pinching cranial. Having done that, I sat there, strapped tight, struck by the undisguised use of the rivet in the seat in front. Everything in the plane was ripped, scuffed, scratched, stripped. Tubes, pipes, cables, and superstructure were all laid bare. Commercial passenger planes from the world's poorest countries outdid this one when it came to frills. Even to compare this plane to anything in the fleets of the budget airlines of the West would give a distorting impression of luxury. Passenger comfort was not a factor in any part of the design process. Having worked itself up to a state of unstoppable intensity, the plane accelerated along a runway for so long it seemed that we were attempting the logically impossible, driving overland to the carrier. At last the ground, glimpsed through the window just behind and to my left, dropped away. We flew over a blur of gulf, but it was neck-achingly awkward, craning backwards to look through the porthole, so I reverted to sitting tight in this silently noisy, vibrating, heavily laden tube, studying rivet patterns. After 40 minutes, the bumpy ride became jumpier still as we descended, bucking the Bronco air. There was a stomach-draining lurch and heave. No, we weren't. The flight attendant's arm came up in a spiraling lasso gesture to indicate that we had missed the arresting wire and were bolting, going up and around again. We circled and tilted round, descended again. This time we thumped down and came to a dead stop. Instantly. It was sudden, but not as violent as I'd expected and feared. Possibly because we were facing backwards and so were forced into our seats, rather than thrown forward and out of them. The ramp hatch at the back of the plane was lowered to reveal that we had landed on another world. Albeit a world with the same pure blue sky as the one we had left. Rotating radars, an American flag. The island, another old new word, referring to the bridge and assorted flight ops rooms rising in a stack from one side of the deck. An island on the island of the carrier. The hatch continued to inch its way down, revealing the flight deck itself, populated by visor-faced beings in red, green, white, yellow jerseys and float coats, parked jets, F-18s and helicopters. We were here. We had arrived on Carrier World. I have never known anything like the suddenness of this change. Compare it with the experience of flying from London and landing in Bombay, from freezing winter to 80-degree heat at 2 in the morning in January. Even a change as dramatic as that is gradual. A 9-hour flight, a long and slow descent, taxiing round the airport to the gate, immigration, baggage claim, leaving the terminal. Typically, it's an hour and a half before you find yourself out in the Indian night with its smell of wood smoke and the sense of vast numbers of people still asleep. Whereas here, one moment we were travelling at 140 miles per hour, and the next we had stopped. The hatch opened and we had entered another world with its own rules, cultures, norms and purposes. The black-visored people were either looking our way or scurrying or lounging or gesturing. Three in white jerseys and float coats stepped onto the ramp and told us to follow in single file. They must have been yelling because we stepped out into a silent world. I had not realized until now how effectively the cranial's ear protection worked, in which steam curled and floated along part of the deck. The air was heavy with the smell of jet fuel. Heat blared from the sky and bounced up off the deck. Three more cranial-headed guys in brown jerseys and trousers were swathed in heavy chains like mechanics in the Middle Ages, in charge of a siege engine. We wanted to dawdle, but had entered a dawdleless and urgent world, where you do what you are told, which was to walk single file to the catwalk at the edge of the deck, and then down the steps to the Air Transfer Office, ATO. Already crowded with people preparing to depart, it was soon full to the brim with those who had just arrived. Ensign Paul Newell, who would be chaperoning us around the boat, squeezed into the room and introduced himself. Always nice to be greeted in an alien world, especially when the greeter is as friendly, smiling and welcoming as Paul. It was like being met at a resort, conveniently located right under the local airport, with a welcome drink and a garland of flowers to hang around your neck. Except there were neither drinks nor garlands. He was wearing a white jersey and sporting something that I would come to recognize as a not uncommon feature of life on the carrier. A form of moustache that has become almost entirely extinct in civilian life. Not an obsolete RAF handlebar extravaganza, just a little under the nose, over the lip number that had no desire to take itself seriously, that spent most of its time in a state of discreet embarrassment at the mere fact of its continued, if meagre, existence. We were ready to go, but we were not ready to go. I had been making notes on the Greyhound, and rather than hanging on to my notebook, had obediently handed it over to the flight attendant who, as we were about to begin that aborted first descent, chucked it into a kit bag with stuff from other passengers. And it had gone missing. So Paul had to set off on a stationary search and rescue. Why hadn't I just crammed it into my pocket? Because I did as I was told. But by doing as I was told, I displayed a lack of initiative, which was now delaying, possibly even jeopardizing the mission. The other new arrivals were taken to their quarters.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?